Evening, folks. Good to see you. Well, last week we had a bit of a roasting again as we looked at Romans chapter 1, which was a kind of bit of an introduction to Romans chapter 2, which is what we're supposed to be doing. And today is already, again, a bit of an introduction about what we're supposed to be doing. When are we ever going to get into it? Well, today we will get into it, but never mind. Right, let's begin. Careful how you judge. The Jews, as we saw last week, well, we saw the Gentile society of the Romans last week in Romans 1, and the Jews looked at that immoral Gentile society, which means non-Jew society, and they happily agreed that those Gentiles had no excuse for living as if God didn't exist. Because God, as we saw last week, had made it plain in the world around us that creation has a creator in Romans 1, 18 to 20. He's also written the truth of his existence on their hearts, 1 verse 21, 25, 28. Further, he's given them a conscience to know deep down what is generally right and wrong in verse 32 of chapter 1. So God then concludes that they are without excuse for all those reasons, and the Jews nod their heads in agreement and happily point the finger. Well, it's one thing for God to point the finger, but quite another for them to, and quite another for you and me to point the finger. So Paul very quickly turns the attention onto these amateur Jewish judges who appear happy to stand in the place of God and condemn all those who aren't the same as them. This is really about hypocritical judging. In 2 verse 1 we read, "You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge the other, you're condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same thing." No excuse for what? Says Paul. For your sin. God says the Gentiles have no excuse for their sin, but Paul says neither do you, you Jews. Paul's addressing an attitude that Jews have towards Gentiles, non-Jews. But he doesn't directly address the Jews at the beginning. He first of all makes an indirect challenge. He uses the word "you" in verse 1 as a general address, almost to say, "I'll shoot this out and this is to whoever the cap fits." And this is a really good approach when you want to raise a particular issue. You don't go in, or it's best not to go in, all guns blazing at first. You make it general. And then once you've got a hearing, you can then begin to make it more direct and specific. Otherwise, by then, if you make it specific at the beginning, the person or people you're trying to direct it to have already shut off and got defensive. And then we think, who has no excuse? Well, our passage says, "You who pass judgment on someone else have no excuse." Why? For at whatever point you judge the other, you're condemning yourself. Well, how's that? Because you who pass judgment do the same things. Many folks read this and other so-called non-judgmental passages of the Bible, and they conclude that no human being should ever judge another human being, because that's God's job and that's only his job. But the Bible actually never says that. Modern psychology says it. A closer look shows that Paul doesn't condemn all judging. He's condemning hypocritical judging. What disqualifies some folks from making a judgment about others is that they are guilty of doing the same things as the person they're judging. And that automatically discounts the person from making that judgment, doesn't it? Because such a person is blind to their own sins, their own weaknesses, their own vulnerabilities in that same area. See, the one who's a hypocritical judge is not spiritually self-aware. This kind of hypocritical judgment proves the old saying, if you point the finger at someone else, you'll get three fingers pointing back at you. You get that in your family all the time, don't you? They know you best. What's the problem, though, here, for real? Well, the Roman church, which Paul's writing to, was made up of mainly non-Jews, Gentiles. And some Jews who were now saved and followed Jesus were part of them too. And the Jews in that fellowship were looking down on the Gentiles. Well, why did they do that? From tiny, first century Jews were taught that Gentiles are not on the same level as Jews. In fact, they're pretty scummy. They're low life. Everyone that isn't a non-Jew is a low life. Even though these Jews had now come to Christ, they still held on to this attitude towards non-Jews in their church. And they looked down on them for two reasons. The Jews were God's original chosen people, so they thought, we're his favorites. And because they were his favorites, God gave them the Old Testament law and the oracles of God. But the Gentiles, they didn't get no law and they weren't the favorites. They then concluded that the Gentiles lived immoral lives because they didn't have the law and were ignorant of the law. And that's why, no wonder then, that these Gentiles are so immoral. That's why they're so immoral. That's why Gentile or Roman society was depraved, just like Romans 1 says. But you know, it's bang up to date because this attitude is still there in the Middle East. Our Jewish friends have the law and they have the prophets, the Old Testament, and they still believe they're God's chosen people, and they still think that by keeping the law, they will earn their salvation. Or at least they'll be a whole lot more moral than those that don't have the law, like us Gentiles. And the similar thinking comes from our Muslim friends. They have Sharia law. They seek to keep Sharia law, which they feel gives them the moral high ground. Muslims think the whole of the West is Christian, including the UK. They look at this so-called Christian Western world and they see the appalling immoral and lawless and sinful and selfish individualistic me and mine life. And they see that anything goes in society, and they see that the UK makes up right and wrong as it goes along in its own eyes. What's right and true for me is true for me, and what's right and true for you is true for you, which obviously can't work. And there's no appeal to God and his requirements of his created. So they look at all this and they think that we're all Christians in the UK, so they conclude that they're better than us and they live much better lives than we do. And who can blame them when that's their perspective? Because many Muslims actually do live better lives than many Westerners in our decadent society. And that's what appalls them so much. It's only when they get to meet a true follower of Jesus that they see the difference. And it's vital that they do see the difference in your life and mine. Otherwise, they're just like anybody else and it will just prove the role for them. And this view today is very similar to these first century Jews looking at the Roman society at the time in Romans 1 and concluding that they're nowhere near as bad as them. And in one sense, they're right. The thing is, though, because they think they're nowhere near as bad as them, they also feel they therefore have the right to judge them. That kind of makes sense, too. But something in us thinks, no, that's wrong. But before we point the finger at the first century Jews, you who know and live for Christ can look at our Christless society and think the same. We see the proud parade, don't we, of all the acts of the sinful nature of the heart, played out graphically on telly, in the news for real, and in the lives of folks we meet. We see the lies of the politicians about Brexit and Remain. Yes, that's the way they say it now. It's so cool, isn't it? I almost was going to do a sermon on the EU referendum, but I withheld myself. Rightly so. You all know how hard I think, anyway. Let's get back to this. So we see that in the news and in the lives of the folk we meet. And we see, don't we, the trashing of marriage between a man and a woman and the redefining of marriage. So it's a man and a man or a woman and a woman or a transgender or whatever you want to call it. And we see the destruction of the family unit that God instituted. We see that marriages are so much easier now to walk away from. We see the violence in society, the sexual immorality, the murder, the abuse, the lies, the deceit, the disrespect. So we who follow Jesus can look at our society and think like these Jews thought of the Gentiles in their day. And we begin to judge, we begin to put the world to rights with one another, we begin to rant and rave, and if we're not careful, we begin to despise this world. You can get so fixed on what's going on around you and all the muck and the evil that you become more and more cynical, and you increasingly begin to remove yourself from everyday folks. Where do you end up? Well, if you're not careful, you end up in a holy huddle, or maybe a holy bubble, or both, that just wants a continual refuge away from this nasty world. What you don't realize is happening there is that what replaces love for the lost, as we would say, is disinterest for the lost, and even dislike for the lost. And positive interaction that once was with the lost is replaced by judgmental interaction. And it produces a holier-than-thou mentality, a looking down on somebody, and they can feel it and they know it, and you'll get nowhere if you start like that. And if you continue to withdraw, you very quickly have an inability to be able to talk properly to anyone that isn't a Christian. Because you don't know how they think. You don't know what they're into. Because you don't have any meaningful contact with people who aren't Christians. But the process doesn't stop there if you're not careful. You increasingly become so narrow-banded. We begin to look down on other Christians too. First it's the world, and then look out, people in the fellowship, other Christians. They do things you'd never dream of doing. They call themselves Christians and they watch that or they do this. It gets worse. They use the New Living Translation, but I use the NIV. They read the Message. You read the King James. Oh, it's faultless, isn't it? My granddad used to say, if it was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for you. King James. It was written in Greek at that time. Or you have a reverse snobbery, where they read the ESV or the King James, but we read a much better modern version. They dress up scruffy for church. Well, I'd never do that, would I? Look how they bring up their kids. They need to get a grip. I'd never let my kids have that. I'd never let my kids speak to me like that. I'd never let my kids do that. Worse, some Christians don't agree with my take on a teaching. And I'm right and they're wrong. And it's black and white and there is no grey areas. I don't care how biblically backed you are, you're wrong. I'm right. Now, of course, I am right. How can they be a Christian and believe that interpretation of the Bible? The trouble is with this process, slowly but surely, you start judging them and you begin to withdraw from them and you lose sight of yourself and your faults and your failings and your sins, often in the very same area. And before you know it, you end up with a very small, narrow-minded, judgmental fellowship full of bigots, self-righteousness, cynicism, and all law, and all truth, and no love. Because the first thing to die is the love. And all truth and no love is not the gospel of Jesus Christ. John 1:14 says, we have seen the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Not just truth. And then 2 John 1:3 says, grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love. Not just truth. And Jesus is full of grace and truth, and full of truth and love. He's the walking, talking good news. He is the gospel incarnate. You know, way before Jesus ever opened his mouth, folks flocked to him because of what he did and because what they heard about him. and because of the love that he showed everyone, except the narrow-band religious elite. He had some wicked words, I don't mean wicked as in evil, some serious words to say to them, because they were exactly like these Jews. Proud, stuck up, truth, no love. Jesus did not like that. He hated that. Those were the only people he singled out, the narrow-band religious elite. He loved the prosies, he loved the druggies, well, if they were druggies. He loved everybody else. And I'm not saying he didn't love them, but he couldn't get through to them, so he told them. He was the direct opposite of all truth and no love brigade. He walked and talked both of them out in perfect tension. Yet these Jews forgot all about that and judged those who weren't like them and weren't the same race as them and didn't think like them and didn't do what they did. You know, there are many churches like that. And they're not gospel churches, doesn't matter what they put up outside. And Christ doesn't walk among them. They've lost connection ages ago with their first love and with the head. He's about to spit them out, and in some cases he already has. Yet still, week after week, they turn the religious wheel. And the sad thing is, they don't even know that God has left their meetings. And they don't know that he left long ago. I don't know whether you've ever been to church like that. I have, and I know of some. Why? 1 Peter 5:5. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud. If you're proud, he'll come up again. He'll fight you if you're proud. But he gives grace to the humble. Look into your own soul this evening. Have you lost that love aspect of the gospel? Are you all truth and no love? Have you become a hypocritical judge? Do you do the same things as the one you judge? Well, I don't know if that's you, but I don't know what Bible you're reading, but it's not the Bible that the Holy Spirit wrote. So Paul's saying to these Jews, hang on a minute, get off your high horse, look at yourselves, because you're just as bad as the folks you're judging. Because I know what's going on in your tiny mind. And that's why here at Park, we hate religion, but we love relationships. Because here's the truth. These Jews were just as guilty as the Gentiles that they were condemning and judging. Maybe not to the extent as the Romans in chapter 1, but still guilty nevertheless, God says. Maybe not so public, but they'd have their similar secret sins. Maybe not as shameless as those Gentiles, but they were shameless about their secret sins. Or if they felt shame, they'd just hide it. And what they loved to do was to wear a holy mask in public. Don't you hate that about church? There's so much hypocrisy, isn't there? We put this holy mask on in public, and you think to yourself afterwards, there's no way he's like that 24/7 with his family, with his kids. They loved to look the part in public. Matthew 23, verse 5. Everything, Jesus says, everything they do, these religious elite, is done for men to see. They want others to think that they're so godly, so holy. But Jesus describes them as a wicked and adulterous generation. He says, Matthew 12, 34, you brood of vipers. How can you, who are evil, say anything good? Because out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. He could see right inside. He knew they were full of dead men's bones, whitewashed tombs outside, looking the part. Matthew 23, he says, you're proud, you're hypocritical, you even murdered the prophets and now the Messiah. I suppose what we need to do is take a break for a second and ask ourselves and ask myself, what are you really like? What kind of a Christian are you when there's nobody around to see when you take your mask off? What kind of attitudes do you hold towards other Christians? Do you talk about them at home in not a good way? Do you judge them? Do you question their salvation when you all along lack assurance of your own salvation? Or do you have the very attitudes that you're accusing them of having? Or do you condemn them for watching this or doing that or for being lustful when you watch stuff you shouldn't? You know, in America, I think it's something as high as 60% of pastors watch porn regularly because they're always by the computer. And in England, it's 30%, probably because some of them don't admit it. How can I, as a pastor, run an anti-porn group like I did if I'm watching porn? Hypocrite. By nature, we are prone to be severe judges of others because it makes us feel better about ourselves. We as judges are often guilty of the same offences. You can passionately be opposed to what you see in others, and it can be pretty convincing, can't you? And you look innocent, and you look like a bastion, an ambassador for doing the right thing, yet you forget that you commit the same thing sometimes. David commits adultery, doesn't he, with another man's wife, Bathsheba, and gets her preggers. He then gets her hubby drunk, so hubby will sleep with Bathsheba, then he'll think the baby's his. Clever. But hubby doesn't sleep with Bathsheba, so David gets him killed in the war. It's all a huge cover-up for David's sin. And David has so lived with it for 9 months, so justified his actions, he can't even see it. He knows something's wrong with him. Things aren't right with him. We see that in the Psalms. He's got psychosomatic illness, you know. He's so laden down with burden about something, but he can't see what it is, and it's affecting him physically. It's sapping his energy. But he's gone along with it, and he can't see what it is. So 9 months later, God, because he cares for him, sends Nathan the prophet to tell him. And Nathan tells him a story, 2 Timothy 12, verse 1 to 6. There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he'd bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, it drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveller came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveller who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David still can't see that what he's done with another man's wife and where Nathan's story's heading. So he says this in verse 5. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man." Passion towards condemning a sin doesn't necessarily mean that the condemner is innocent of that same sin. Your anger and passion may be due actually to your own struggles with that sin, but you take it out on someone else for doing the same sin. Before you and I judge or condemn sin in others, you and I better make sure that we're not doing it ourselves. Maybe that's why you get so angry, because actually you see it in yourself, you're struggling with it, you hate it. So you have a go at somebody else who does it. And the other side of this is that sometimes you can show hostility to one kind of sin in others so you can somehow calm your conscience for a different sin that you're doing. I really hate that sin. And in condemning it, you kind of feel a bit better about your different sin. Maybe because you think that your sin isn't as bad as his or hers. Or at least you're not guilty of his sin. At least I'm okay, I'm clean in that area. So I can feel a little bit better about this area. The heart is deceitful. Before you seek to make a judgment on a sin in others, make sure you're not appeasing your conscience about another kind of sin in you. This kind of hypocritical condemnatory judgment is what's forbidden in the Bible. But let me finish with this. Helping another person through a struggle they have with sin or with a sin is very important. We mustn't ignore the struggles of our fellow believers and say nothing in the name of non-judgmentalism. That's just as bad. You're watching them head over a cliff and saying, go on then, I'm not going to tell you. That's not love, is it? But what we have to do is always seek to help, restore, reconcile with all love and grace as well as truth. And Jesus encourages us to do exactly this. Let me finish by what he says. Matthew 7:1, so misinterpreted so often. He doesn't say don't judge, this is what he says. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? Now, most Christians stop there and they say, right, you can't judge about anything. You can't make any evaluation about anything. And you certainly can't say anything to somebody else about what they're doing wrong. No. Carry on. You hypocrite. That bit's wrong. You hypocrite, Jesus says. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. See? That is exactly what Paul's saying. And that's what opens up this next chapter. Amen.